Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the third week of January. My name is Elise Hugh, joined by regular podcasters Evan Smith.
Hey, Elise.
And Ben Philpott.
Hello.
Today we have a special guest sitting in for Ross Ramsey, Reeve Hamilton, who is a Bay Stater and also wants to gab a little bit about KBH's remarkably consistent stance on abortion. I'll be talking about Deborah Medina's post-debate surge. And Evan and Ben, you guys can take it away with the pretty stunning upset in Massachusetts in the Senate race there and how it affects Texas. Evan?
Well, I think it was a stunning upset, but we'd been really told for several days now that it was going to happen, so I wasn't that stunned, although I think there were probably a lot more people who were upset. It wasn't an upset in the sense that I think we had come to expect that he was going to win, and frankly, had Martha Choakley held on and actually won that race, that would have been the upset by last night. But it points to the peril for Democrats nationally and in local races this fall. We are in uncharted territory. The extent to which the national political scene is impacting local races, statewide races, I just don't think we know right now. And what the Brown race, which can be explained away through a series of, I think, legitimate local issues. She was a terrible candidate, one of the worst of all time. They, as a Democratic Party, both in Massachusetts and nationally, sat on what they assumed to be an insurmountable lead, didn't really engage, didn't take him seriously. There are all kinds of reasons why you could say this was a local deal. But the reality is we got to look at this and think if Ted Kennedy's seat for all those years can go to a relatively unknown nude model turned state senator. I mean, that's what the guy is. They showed photographs of him posing naked in whatever it was, like Cosmo or something. And I thought
Playgirl, I believe.
Playgirl. This is clearly a Photoshop deal. No, it's actually him. If that can happen, then I think every single Democrat in any race in which there's even the slightest hint of outrage at Washington needs to wonder whether the sound that he or she hears behind is footsteps that are coming at a very fast pace. And so if I'm, there are races in Texas that we assume Democrats are going to hold on to, but, you know, who knows?
But if there is a special election for Senate in Texas, if Kay Bailey Hutchison does indeed step down, Ben, you were talking about how this could make John Sharp a very popular man.
Well, absolutely. If John Sharp, if Kay Bailey Hutchison does at some point finally resign from the Senate and there's a special election, the Democrats have a few month window to maybe get back that supermajority in the Senate by winning the Texas special election. It gives them a lame duck supermajority, but it would give them a supermajority again if they needed to kick the health care bill back to the Senate, which is now the big debate. So what do you do with this health care bill? Are you going to need to get it passed without sending it back to the Senate because the supermajority is gone? I'm at some point today, I'm supposed to be talking with Congressman Lloyd Doggett about that. He's Austin's state rep, Austin's congressman. He's been very critical of the Senate plan. Doesn't like the fact that the public option's gone, been critical on other issues. But now he's going to be one of those Democrats that Nancy Pelosi and maybe the President Obama administration are going to be coming to and saying, look, let's vote for this. Let's get it clean through the House so then we don't have to bother with the Senate and it just goes straight to the president and he signs it into law. Well, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what, Doggett's in a pretty safe district, but it'll be interesting to see what other Democrats who have been complaining about the Senate version of the bill end up doing when the decision is to stick to what they've been saying and send it back to the Senate where it could just get completely blown apart, or hold their nose and vote with what the Democratic leadership is asking them to do and then get run out on a rail when election time comes around.
We are looking at half a loaf city here for the Democrats. They would love to have the whole loaf. They're going to have to accept half a loaf, and those Democrats in the House who are fulminating about the public option and everything else, while they may legitimately believe that's what they like, we live in the world that is, not the world that we wish it was. And as of last night, the world that is they better pass the Senate bill if they want to see health care reform happen. So you Massachusetts Hamilton over there, why don't you explain to us what exactly transpired last night from your particular lens?
Well, I think you sort of covered it. I mean, Martha Coakley was a bad candidate, and she ran against a guy that played it pretty smart. I mean, they sort of blitzed her in the media. They stuck to a clear image. They got Doug Flutie and Kurt Schilling on her side, as opposed to Tom Menino, the mayor of Boston. If I'm just someone there who doesn't pay much attention to politics, but, you know, thinks that I'll go with Kurt. You know, they tend to go with Kurt Schilling. She also,
I'm not a Red Sox fan, and even I would rather listen to Kurt Schilling.
Yeah. Coakley insulted Kurt Schilling on top of that and called him a Yankees fan, which isn't, you know, that's not going to help anyone.
Ooh, a Yankees fan. Ooh.
So, I mean, you had the part of that. You also had, I know some people I know were just really incensed about the Massachusetts state legislature's, the Democrats' approach to replacing Ted Kennedy, because they had changed the rules so that when they were in the minority, they would have power by having a special election instead of an appointment. And then they were in the majority when Ted Kennedy died and were not too happy about having to have this election.
Well, in fact, they would have preferred to have Deval Patrick. God, Roland Burris would have been a preferable outcome to this, right? I mean, they would have preferred to have an appointment, but that wasn't the way that the law was drafted.
You know, I was talking to another Bay Stater this morning, actually, and he had an interesting thought on why it happened the way it did. He thinks that it wasn't so much the healthcare debate, because Massachusetts already has the kind of healthcare system.
96% coverage or something, yeah.
So he thought that it was that there may have been the grassroots progressive Netrooter Democrats who didn't come out for this, didn't get excited about this because the Democrats in Massachusetts were playing a moderate card throughout the entire election. And if they had played a more progressive card, liberal card, however you want to say it, that maybe it would have gotten Democrats more excited. And you know, but she probably wasn't the candidate to play that card.
Right. I think that's probably true. You know, you can't just, you have to chalk it up, I think, as much to her as you do to the national mood. I mean, I think 538 was talking about there was a 31-point swing in Massachusetts from the Obama election, which today's the anniversary of his inauguration, right? And in a year, that's a pretty big swing. Nationally, maybe there's a net 10% loss for Democrats. So you got to give her at least, you know,
28% yeah, of it. Yeah, give her
well, as you divide up the blame, I think, though, you know, she was a terrible candidate. She campaigned terribly, which is not always the same thing. She was a bad candidate inherently, but bad candidates have been elected. But when a bad candidate campaigns badly and arrogantly and assumes that because this is a Democratic state and because it was a Democratic seat, naturally, I, Martha Coakley, will win. That's kind of how they ran this whole race, and, you know, they handed it over to the Republicans. Now, the practical impact of this, first of all, Democrats still have 59 senators. I mean, that's, you know, okay, you don't have 60, which is a problem in the immediate, but you still got a pretty big majority. Second thing is, you know, the best thing here may be for the House just to pass the Senate bill. I'm actually not convinced that if the House got into it and had all these changes they wanted to make, that there would have been any way to achieve consensus between the House and the Senate bills. It might have dragged out longer. This may be ultimately the best thing for the Democrats who want to pass health care, is that the House has to accept, okay, this was going to be fine, pass it, get it done, get it signed. I know it's being made out to be this terrible disaster for the Democrats, but, you know, maybe it isn't going to be so bad.
Well, and, you know, even a milquetoast bill that some of the House Democrats think they're getting back from the Senate still has some very good things, getting rid of the pre-existing conditions, other things that, you know, whether or not we're going to get total coverage or however that's going to work out, you have people that will benefit from something getting passed.
Well, come back to the Sharp thing for a second. This was a point that was made this morning in the Houston Chronicle's blog. Other people were talking about the fact that Sharp could be an unintended beneficiary of Scott Brown's victory because, as you said, Ben, the Democrats are now looking to the next opportunity to win back that 60th vote. And if Hutchison resigns after the primary and the governor appoints somebody and then there's a special election kicked in, potentially John Sharp as the Democratic nominee or the Democratic contender for that seat. The question, though, is, are there enough Democrats in Texas to elect a Democrat statewide? I mean, it just comes back to that. And I just don't know that Sharp or Bill White or the man in the moon has an opportunity running as a Democrat to win statewide yet. I know there's a lot of optimism on the part of Democrats, but it just may be more wishful thinking than anything else.
Well,
go ahead. And especially in a year when independents are not breaking towards Democrats.
No.
And I just think it's interesting that this Senate race that we've pretty much stopped paying much attention to because there's no real set date for it could actually become the Senate race where a bunch of national attention and national dollars come in because it's the fight for that. It could be that the fight to regain that 60th seat. So it would be interesting that John Sharp could be a beneficiary of just good timing.
Well, you know what? But good timing has been crucial to just about everything in the world.
Yeah, it's about politics.
Well,
yeah.
I just think it'll be interesting to see whether or not is it Harold Ford comes back down from New York.
Right.
Maybe Harold Ford could run for the Senate.
He could run. He could come down to Texas, set up residency, and
pedicures for everybody. Hey, I want to know, Elise, so do you think that Hutchinson's going to resign after the primary, as she has insisted and as your friend Joe Pounder has insisted?
Well, my good friend Joe Pounder, her spokesman, has said again and again that she does plan on, the plan has been the same, that once this climate change bill fight and once the healthcare fight is over, she will come home. But we don't know when that those fights will actually be
can
over.
Can I just ask what the thinking behind that is? Like, why is that supposed to convince me that she is just in it for, you know, the governor's race? Like, why, if I'm a voter, why do I care if she's coming back no matter what?
Well, I frankly don't know if I were a voter, what the benefit to me as a Texan would be to her quitting if she loses the primary.
Right.
Why not just stay a senator?
Wouldn't I want her in the Senate if she, I mean, she has seniority, she's...
I don't understand what the answer to that is.
Well, while we're talking about her, Reeve, I know you've been looking a lot into a story you're doing for Thursday on Kay Bailey's stance on abortion over the years.
Yeah, well, she had a sort of tricky moment during the debate last week, and it's a tricky moment she's had before with – she got asked – and to be fair, the moderators didn't help her any, but she got asked, you know, do you think that Roe v. Wade should be overturned? She said – she didn't say yes or no, but she said, I think if you did that, that some states would ban it outright, but the real problem is that some states, probably like Scott Brown's Massachusetts, would become – abortion havens. And then one of the moderators raised the specter of back alley abortions, which was not mentioned, but she was talking about legal abortions. I don't know if that analysis is actually accurate, but she's always had this problem of, her position has always been, I am for Roe versus Wade staying in effect. Her reasoning behind that has changed somewhat. It used to be because I believe, you know, that up until viability, that women should have a choice, and after that, and the government shouldn't intervene. Now it's this abortion haven argument. But, I mean, that doesn't change her. She's always been for Roe versus Wade, but she's also always been for just about every restriction on abortion that's come down, you know, that she's been for everything that Rick Perry has signed. She, I think NARAL has given her a 0% rating in over half of her years in the Senate.
She never Reeve self-identifies as pro-choice.
No.
But she doesn't – can she self-identify as pro-life? I mean, that's why there's problems with labels, right? Because this is such a
– I always thought
position.
That she was actually on the record as supporting the right of a woman with certain restrictions, and as you say, maybe every restriction, to end a pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean, most of her votes in the Senate have been sort of along the lines of – her votes in the Senate that have been classified as sort of pro-choice friendly have been like – restrictions on people committing violent acts at abortion clinics and or protesting outside of those, which is
you know, nothing to do with abortion.
Yeah, right. It's just as much about sort of domestic safety issues.
I'm just waiting for Mark Miner's email on how Kay is now against states' rights.
because she
thinks Roe versus Wade
the abortion haven states.
Because of the abortion haven states, you know. I mean, of course, I'm missing the amendment now.
Tenth Amendment.
Thank you. There we go.
But I mean, but even that one, even though she's been consistently pro-restriction, her sort of continued support for Roe versus Wade might be enough for Perry to exploit in the next month plus in the primary. He's going to be speaking
because
at the Texas rally for life.
The base is like rabidly, rigidly pro-life,
right?
And the base believes, which is probably a fair thing to say, that on the issue of abortion, he's more in their camp than she is.
Right, but she's pretty much as much in their camp as far as things a governor can do. I mean, a governor can't overturn Roe v. Wade. They can only sort of encourage restrictions, and she's always been for that.
Yeah, but governor's races for all time have been about things that governors have nothing to do with. It's all grandstanding, right? Right. In theory, one of the ways that the governor, this current governor, can put a wedge between Senator Hutchinson and the rightist wing of the party is by saying she's not actually with you on abortion.
So more than anything else, this is a rhetorical problem for her because she can't.
Well, she didn't give a very good answer. What I've heard, and of course I can't say this because I wasn't there, was that, and you alluded to the moderators not helping her, that the way the debate was supposed to be structured, there wasn't supposed to be follow-ups.
Right.
And the moderators of the debate lost control of it, and so it became this kind of anarchy deal.
The follow-ups were the best part, I thought.
The follow-ups were the best part.
Once the candidates ran away with it, the moderators decided that they could too.
Right, that's true.
Free for all.
So she did a very good answer on the first question, but wasn't actually
Not prepared for the follow-up.
Prepared for the follow-up. You know, this is a tricky line to walk for any Republican candidate, even in 2010. If you are a pro-choice Republican, it is assumed, except in most, except in almost every case, except in very rare instances, you have a ceiling over your head in terms of how you can move up in the party. Both Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani, for instance, found running for president that even the taint of having once upon a time been sympathetic to the pro-choicers was this terrible albatross around their necks. Any pro-choice Republican in Texas, I mean, Susan Combs is a great example. Susan Combs, unlike Senator Hutchison, the Comptroller of Public Accounts, has always been pro-choice, has said so. When she says it and she admits it, she does it kind of with a resignation. Yeah, I'm pro-choice. Because she knows that it ultimately doesn't help her prospects going forward. And it's a tough thing for a Republican to be pro-choice in this state. It just is.
And it's tough to put into a soundbite form for a debate.
And it's a real shame for Republicans because, you know, I think people on both sides of this issue can admit that this is a wedge issue. You know, this isn't an issue that affects a lot of people at once, you know, in the way that pocketbook issues do or healthcare, for example. So, you know, it's kind of a shame that Republican candidates who may not fall in line, you know, 100% on this pro-life, pro-choice test have this particular problem.
And, you know, Planned Parenthood has always factored into this in an interesting way because, you know, George Bush the Elder used to be, I believe, on the board of Planned Parenthood in Harris County. Joe Strauss, the current Speaker of the House's wife, had previously been a donor to, if not a board member at, the Planned Parenthood in Bexar County, I believe. I mean, there's a sort of noblesse oblige wing of the Republican Party of old, of not too long ago, saw this as one issue that they could embrace, but, you know, not anymore.
So the question I want to ask this week is about this new fascination with Debra Medina. She has surged in the Rasmussen poll, tripled her showing since last fall to 12%, now in the double digits. There's a lot of talk that she could possibly force a runoff. And, you know, she's just going full steam ahead. Her supporters are all kinds of excited for her, you know, very Ron Paul-esque in the way that they're backing her. Money bomb today, a bigger money bomb February 2nd. These are the tactics that Ron Paul's supporters used in order to raise $6 million for him in a single day in 2007. So, you know, Debra Medina, I feel like this is kind of an interesting thing going on in the late few weeks of this race.
Well, should we be careful about sort of classifying it in terms of percentage, in terms of like tripling? She's gone up 8 points.
Right. She's gone up from 4 to 12.
Right. But that doesn't mean she's going to go from 12 to 36.
Right. That's like buying Dell stock at 4 and selling it at 8. That doesn't mean I'm going to get rich, but it did double.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. Good counterpoint.
but you know, this is
my first one.
That was pretty good. This is the issue, I think, that we need to consider, which is reality. Debra Medina is not going to win this election. She's just not. Sorry, Debra. Sorry, Nelda. Sorry, people associated with Debra Medina. She's just not going to win. It's not going to happen. You know, can she have an impact on who wins on the outcome of the race? Yes, she can have an impact on the race. Absolutely. I think she probably does threaten pretty seriously throwing this into a runoff. Wouldn't you say, Ben?
Absolutely.
I mean, 12%, her percentage of the vote is now larger than the margin between Hutchison
right.
and Perry.
And as long as that happens, then it's going to be a runoff. I wonder how much attention we're paying to her because of the movement that she represents and not necessarily what her poll numbers are or, you know, first of all, she did really well in the debate. Much better, right. I think. Than Kinky Friedman or Carol Keaton Strayhorn.
Exceeded expectations.
In 2006.
You don't mean well, you mean better than you thought, or you mean actually she did well?
I thought she did well. I mean, she, you know, as I've said in other podcasts, she's a true believer, so she knows how to give her answers. She doesn't waver. And I think that, but I wonder how much of the coverage she's getting is because she's seems to be doing okay, or if it's because she represents this Tea Party movement, which has for the last year gotten tons of news coverage.
Speaking of that, Rick Perry is going to be campaigning with Sarah Palin, who's one of the sort of icons of this movement. Does that steal him against Debra Medina Drainage?
That sounds like a good band name, Debra Medina Drainage. I've never actually heard that phrase before.
It doesn't. I don't think it hurts.
I mean, Hutchison has Dick Cheney. He's got Sarah Palin. I mean, this is a good thing to watch. All these famous people coming in from out of the state to campaign with these guys. But is it going to make a difference in the end? I don't know.
I mean, you know, it's not like this is a new addition to the Perry camp. Palin's always been a Perry supporter, so it's not like all of a sudden at the last second Perry thought, you know, let's get Palin in here and she'll help, you know, stop that erosion for the Medina camp. But it is, I mean, you're right, it's the same kind of voters.
Yeah, the other issue on the Medina front, Elise, is, yeah, the good news is she's like Ron Paul. The bad news is she's like Ron Paul. What kind of an impact did Ron Paul have on the outcome of the last race? None.
Did he get like one delegate in New Hampshire, I think?
Well, but the point is, yeah, he raised a lot of money, but ultimately he didn't affect the outcome of the election at all. He didn't even change the conversation going on in the Republican Party sufficiently.
Yeah, and if we're going to be realistic about it, I think the reason to closely watch her is because of what her surge portends for the Titans, for Perry and Hutchison. You know, where she's stealing votes from, if any, or is this a separate movement of voters that
if
are
she loses
in?
The primary, yeah. Does she endorse one or the other right. candidate? Does her movement come along with her to that
absolutely.
Candidate?
Absolutely. So, right. I mean, I think we should look at this phenomenon through that lens primarily. But, you know, she is going to get more scrutiny. She has been invited to debate again next Friday in Dallas. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether either of the candidates, the main candidates, Hutchison and Perry, will actually ask her substantive questions on the issues and challenge some of her positions.
Well, I'm looking forward to another Hutchison-Medina tag team on Governor Perry. The funniest moment of the whole entire debate was Kay Bailey Hutchison saying, you know, Deborah, Perry said he was going to lower our property taxes. Tell me about the meetings you've been to where people said that's, you know, a crock.
Right. She really effectively, Hutchison really effectively used Medina. In her opportunity to ask Medina a question. So,
well, and Perry sort of accidentally ignored her at first. Technically, his first question to Medina was, when will you resign from the Senate?
Right. He was making a joke, obviously, about Hutchison there. So,
yeah. Well, I want to come back to this idea that you just raised about how Perry and Hutchison may have to attack Medina. On what? In other words, where is there a policy position of Medina's that Perry and Hutchison would take issue with?
She has left the door open for decriminalizing marijuana, for instance. She wants to repeal the concealed handgun law.
She wants to conceal
guns at grocery stores.
Handgun law
might not translate to the general election.
She wanted to take her gun into the frozen foods aisle, I thought.
So that's why
she wants to repeal it so you can actually have more guns?
Right, because the concealed handgun law includes many restrictions.
Well, she believes that the public should be more armed than the law enforcement, right?
Right.
So that we can protect ourselves against them.
Exactly. So she's won Jerry Patterson's vote.
But, you know, even then, if either Perry or Hutchison were to step out on the ledge and say something about her position on guns, the other could very easily turn around and say, they're anti-gun.
Right.
Now, the decriminalizing marijuana part, I think only the press would agree with that, probably, right? That the people in, but nobody. I don't think that there's not a single person in their party who's going to. I'd be shocked if that became a problem for them to attack her on that. But the reality is, most of the people in the Republican Party are not going to take very kindly to those guys attacking Medina on substance because most of what she says.
Like totally getting rid of the property tax in favor of a
she probably does
sales
better on the purity
instead.
Test
yeah.
than they do.
She,
maybe
she probably does.
Well, and her voters are voters that they're going to want in the runoff.
Oh my goodness! Of course, then they're going to. Well, if there's a runoff, obviously who Medina endorses and who her folks support is going to be the ballgame.
Another lively discussion. Thank you, Reeve, for sitting in on the Tribcast.
Oh, thank you.
Hope it was a good time. On behalf of Evan, Ben, and Ross, who was not with us today, thank you for listening.